episode of the Rubber Duck Radio. I am your host, Tim Williams, back from a week vacation in D.C. Here with me is none other than Paul Mason.
Hey, Tim, how was Washington?
It was awesome. I'll tell you, the amount of free museums that are in the Capitol Mall can keep you there for weeks if you're willing.
So how many did you hit?
All told, we hit, I think, 5 if I'm counting right. Yeah. Keep in mind there are monuments and other non-museum things to do while you're there.
What were your favorite museums?
Well, we've talked about this before, so you might not be surprised to learn that the Museum of Natural History is number one for this dino nerd. The second was the National Air and Space Museum. The exhibits there were top-notch.
I've only been to D.C. as a kid on a field trip, but I was too young to remember much. What stuck out to you?
Oh man, where do I even start? So the Natural History Museum has this massive fossil hall called Deep Time, and the centerpiece is a T-Rex. But it's not just standing there like a statue. It's posed mid-fight with a triceratops, like they're locked in battle. It's dramatic as hell.
That's awesome. Is it a real skeleton?
Yeah, it's one of the most complete T-Rex skeletons ever found, about 63% real bone.
Oh.
They call it Stan. But here's the thing that blew my mind. The whole exhibit covers 4.6 billion years of Earth's history with about 700 fossil specimens. And there's this palm tree fossil from Alaska.
Wait, palm trees in Alaska?
Right? That's the point. It shows how dramatically Earth's climate has shifted over time. Alaska used to be tropical. The planet's been through a lot.
That's wild. What else caught your eye?
Okay, so the Hope Diamond is there too, the famous blue diamond. And I learned the wildest story about how it got to the Smithsonian. So this thing started as a 115-carat stone sold to King Louis XIV in 1669. It became part of the French crown jewels. Then it gets stolen during the French Revolution in 1792. Disappears for 20 years, resurfaces in London, recut down to 45 carats.
And then it ends up in D.C.?
Eventually, but here's the part I can't get over. Harry Winston, you know, the famous jeweler, he donated it to the Smithsonian in 1958, and he mailed it in a plain brown package via registered mail.
No way, the Hope Diamond? Mailed like a sweater from Amazon?
Yeah, I'm not making this up. The most famous diamond in the world, worth $250 million, just dropped in a mailbox. And you know the curse? The whole bad luck follows this diamond thing?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Total fabrication. Pierre Cartier made it up in the early 1900s as a sales tactic. And since it's been at the Smithsonian, nothing but good luck. The curse appears to have gone dormant.
That's hilarious. Marketing from 100 years ago still has people spooked.
Exactly. Now, the Air and Space Museum, that one hit different for me. You walk in and there's the actual 1903 Wright Flyer. The real one, not a replica, the actual plane that inaugurated the aerial age.
That's pretty surreal to see in person.
Totally. And right next to it, in the Destination Moon Gallery, they've got the Apollo 11 command module Columbia and Neil Armstrong's spacesuit displayed together. The actual capsule that went to the moon and back. And the suit he wore when he took that first step.
I love how they pair those things together, the beginning of flight and the moon landing in one building.
It's a timeline you can walk through. And here's a fun bit of trivia. The museum's first director was Michael Collins.
Ah, wait, the Apollo 11 astronaut? The one who stayed in the command module?
That's the one. The guy who orbited the moon alone while Armstrong and Aldrin were walking on the surface ended up running the museum that houses his own spacecraft. There's something poetic about that.
That's a full circle moment if I've ever heard one.
Right? And Paul, I have to tell you this because it made me laugh. They have a full-sized X-Wing starfighter from Star Wars hanging outside the planetarium.
Shut up, really?
I'm serious. From The Rise of Skywalker. And they've also got the original 11-foot studio model of the Starship Enterprise from the original Star Trek series. So you've got real space history next to fictional space history, and somehow it works.
That's perfect. Science fiction inspiring science fact all in one place.
Exactly. You can even touch an actual moon rock. There's something profound about putting your hand on a piece of another world.
Sounds like an amazing trip. I definitely need to get back there as an adult.
Oh, you do. And the best part? All of it is free. Every single museum on the National Mall. You can walk through billions of years of history and the entire history of human flight without paying a dime.
That's one thing I remember from my visit. I love that it's accessible to everyone like that.
Yeah, it's one of those things that makes you proud, you know? But here's the thing. Stepping away from my desk for a week, being out there in the real world, walking through museums, standing in lines, sitting in restaurants, it hit me in a way I wasn't expecting.
What do you mean?
So I've been heads down, right? 60, maybe 80 hours a week, building with AI, testing workflows, writing code with LLMs, iterating on prompts. It's become second nature. It's just how I work now. And I think we're both in that boat.
Oh, absolutely. It's weird when I have to work without it at this point.
Right? But here's what struck me. Being out in the world, watching people work, seeing how things actually get done outside our bubble, I realized something. Almost nobody is using this stuff.
Yeah?
I mean, think about it. We talk about AI like it's this massive civilization-level shift, and I believe it is. But then you watch a museum docent giving a tour, or a restaurant manager coordinating a dinner rush, or a construction crew working on a building, and they're not using ChatGPT. They're not prompting Claude. They're just working the way people have worked for decades.
That's a really good point. We're in this weird bubble where it feels like everyone must be using AI because it's so transformative. But the reality is,
we're still the early adopters. Like, early. We're the ones who jumped in head first, who saw the potential and started building habits around it. But the rest of the world, they're just moving along, business as usual, as if this step change in technology hasn't even happened yet.
It's almost disorienting when you think about it. In our world, we're already debating context windows and model selection and agentic workflows. And outside that bubble, people are like, oh yeah, I've heard of ChatGPT, never really used it though.
Exactly. And it made me think about how insulated we are as developers. We're always at the bleeding edge of tooling, but this feels different. This isn't just a new framework or a new text editor. This is a fundamental shift in how knowledge work could be done. And yet most knowledge workers aren't even aware of what they're missing.
Do you think that's going to change quickly, or are we looking at a slower adoption curve than the hype suggests?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I don't have a clean answer, but I've been thinking about it a lot since I got back. And honestly, the answer might be playing out right now in this really interesting battle between OpenAI and Anthropic. Like, have you noticed how much the ground has shifted in the last year or so?
Oh yeah, it's been wild to watch.
So here's the thing. OpenAI spent basically all of 2023 and 2024 chasing consumer wins. ChatGPT, Sora, all these flashy product launches. And they were winning the consumer game, right? ChatGPT hit 800 million weekly active users. That's insane. But while they were doing that, they took their eye off the developer ball.
Big time. I mean, I was still using their API, but it felt like they stopped caring about what developers actually needed. The focus was all on these consumer-facing products.
Right. And here's the number that blew my mind. OpenAI's enterprise market share went from 50% in 2023 down to 25% by mid-2025. They got cut in half in 2 years. That's a massive collapse.
Wait, cut in half? That's huge.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Anthropic went from like 12% to 32% in the same period. They basically ate OpenAI's lunch.
And I know exactly why. It's because Anthropic went all in on developers and enterprise contracts while OpenAI was chasing viral moments.
Exactly. And the coding numbers are even more stark. Claude now holds 54% of the AI coding market. OpenAI is at 21%. That's a complete flip from where we were 2 years ago.
Claude Code specifically has been a game changer. I mean, the fact that Microsoft, the company that sells GitHub Copilot, has widely adopted Claude Code internally, that says everything.
That's the wildest part. And Claude Code hit 1 to 2 billion ARR just 6 months after launch. That's faster than ChatGPT's trajectory. Anthropic went from under 1,000 business customers to over 300,000 in 2 years. Revenue jumped from $1 billion to $5 billion in 8 months.
The terminal native approach was smart. Instead of trying to be an IDE plugin, they built something that meets developers where they already work.
Totally. And here's where it connects back to what we were talking about. OpenAI finally woke up. They had their dev day in late 2025, and it was all about winning developers back. New APIs, an agent's SDK, agent kit. They even shut down Sora, which was burning $15 million a day, by the way, to refocus on Codex.
$15 million a day on Sora?
Yeah. And downloads had already tanked from 3.3 million to 1.1 million in 3 months. Disney was supposedly going to invest $1 billion, and that fell through when they killed it. It was a mess.
So they're pivoting back to developers because they have to, not because they want to.
That's exactly it. And I think it ties into this bigger question about what these companies are actually building toward. OpenAI has been very vocal about this AGI goal. But here's the thing, and I've been reading a lot about this. There's a growing consensus among AI researchers that AGI isn't actually possible with current LLM architecture.
Yeah, I've seen some of that discussion. What's the core argument?
So Yann LeCun, he's Meta's chief AI scientist, Turing Award winner, one of the godfathers of deep learning. He's been very vocal about this. He says LLMs have four fundamental limitations. One, they have no understanding of the physical world. They only know text, not reality. Two, no persistent memory. Every interaction starts fresh. Three, no genuine reasoning. It's just pattern matching, not deliberative thinking. And four, no planning capability. They can't coordinate multi-step goals autonomously.
That tracks with what I've seen. They're amazing at pattern matching, but when you need actual reasoning or planning, they fall apart.
Right. And LeCun's point is that a 4-year-old has seen about 10 to the 15th power bytes of visual data. LLMs are trained on 10 to the 13th power bytes of text. We're 2 orders of magnitude short just on data volume, and more importantly, we're learning from text instead of the physical world. He straight up says LLMs will be obsolete within 5 years. He's advising young developers not to work on LLMs.
That's a strong take from someone at his level.
It is, and he's not alone. François Chollet, the creator of Keras, he calls LLMs an off-ramp on the path to AGI. There's academic research showing LLMs can't maintain intellectual consistency, they struggle with novel situations, they can be talked out of correct answers with bad arguments. They're what psychologists call System 1 thinking, reactive, intuitive, pattern matching. But they lack System 2, that slow, deliberative, logical reasoning.
So OpenAI is chasing this AGI goal, but the architecture itself might be a dead end.
That's the argument. And meanwhile, Anthropic said, you know what, let's not worry about AGI. Let's build tools that developers and enterprises actually need right now. Let's win the coding market. Let's win the enterprise contracts. And they did.
It's like the tortoise and the hare. OpenAI was chasing this lofty, possibly impossible goal, and Anthropic just put their head down and built practical stuff.
Right. And here's the moral of the story. While OpenAI was focused on this AGI moonshot, they lost half their enterprise market share. Now they're scrambling to get it back. Anthropic's projected to break even by 2028. OpenAI's not profitable until 2030. The strategy difference is playing out in real numbers.
And it connects to what you were saying about being in a bubble. Like, OpenAI was in their own bubble, the AGI bubble, and they missed what was actually happening on the ground with developers.
Exactly. And I think that's the lesson for all of us. It's easy to get caught up in the hype, in the big vision, and what could be possible someday. But the real value, the real adoption, comes from building things that solve actual problems for actual people right now.
So here's the question that's been rattling around in my head since you sent me that research. If LLMs really are hitting a wall, or even just plateauing, what does that mean for us, for developers who've gone all in on this stuff?
Yeah, and zoom out even further. What does it mean for the people pouring billions of dollars into this technology? Because we're talking about massive bets on a future that might not materialize the way they're expecting.
Right, the Sequoia analysis, the $600 billion gap.
Exactly. David Kahn at Sequoia put out this analysis that's been making the rounds. He's saying that to justify the current infrastructure investment in AI, companies need to generate $600 billion in annual revenue that doesn't currently exist. Current AI revenue is around $3 to $4 billion. So you're talking about a gap of almost $600 billion that needs to materialize out of thin air.
That's a staggering number. How do you even close that gap?
Here's the math. Microsoft, Google, Meta, Amazon, they're collectively spending over $200 billion a year on AI infrastructure. At a 20% margin, that requires $1 trillion in revenue. Total AI software revenue right now, $3 to $4 billion. Even if AI revenue grows 100 times, it's still not enough.
So either AI revenue explodes way beyond what anyone's projecting, or...
or we're in a bubble. And bubbles burst. Kahn actually draws a parallel to the dot-com era. In 1999, about $1 trillion worth of fiber optic infrastructure was built. By 2005, only 5% of that capacity was being used. The infrastructure was right, the timing was wrong, companies went bankrupt, the fiber got bought for pennies on the dollar.
And the survivors, Amazon, Google, built empires on cheap infrastructure.
Right. So the question becomes, are we in 1999? Is all this GPU infrastructure the new fiber optic cables?
I mean, there's one big difference. The fiber optic bubble was built on the promise of the internet transforming everything, and it did, just not as fast as investors wanted. Is AI the same way?
That's the bull case. Sam Altman says the curve is still exponential, we're just in a transition period. Dario Amodei at Anthropic says we're not hitting a wall, we're hitting a different part of the curve. The J-curve argument. Sometimes progress looks flat before it jumps again.
But then you've got the bears. Gary Marcus is out there saying we're heading for another AI winter.
Yeah, and he's got historical precedent. AI has gone through these cycles before. The 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s. Hype builds, funding pours in, the technology plateaus, disappointment sets in, funding collapses. The difference this time is that there's real commercial value. Claude Code is doing $1 to $2 billion in ARR. That's not vaporware. But the question is whether there's $600 billion worth of value.
Okay, so let's say the bubble does burst. What happens to developers like us?
Here's the thing, and this is where I think the conversation gets interesting. Developers might actually be in the sweet spot. The productivity gains from AI coding tools are real and measurable. We're talking 30 to 50% faster coding, 2 to 5 times faster for boilerplate. That's actual value being created right now, not speculative future value.
Right. I'm using this stuff every day, and it's genuinely useful. I shipped features last week that would have taken me twice as long without Claude. That's real.
Exactly. And here's the key insight. Even if LLMs plateau, learning to work with AI is a permanent skill shift. It's like learning to use a compiler or a version control system. The specific tools might change, but the skill of leveraging AI to be more productive, that's durable.
But there are risks, right? If investment dries up, what happens to all these free and cheap AI tools we've gotten used to?
Yeah, that's a real concern. Right now, a lot of these tools are subsidized by venture capital money. Companies are burning cash to gain market share. If the funding environment tightens, API pricing could spike. The days of cheap tokens might end. We could see consolidation, smaller AI companies getting acquired or shutting down.
So enjoy the cheap AI while it lasts.
Maybe. But also, don't build your entire workflow around a single vendor or a single model. Diversify, learn the fundamentals, be the person who knows how to apply AI to real problems, not the person who's dependent on a specific tool that might not exist in 5 years.
That's solid advice, but let's talk about the other side of this, the investors. What happens to them if this bubble bursts?
Oh, they're the ones who could really get hurt. You've got Microsoft with $13 billion in OpenAI, NVIDIA with a $3 trillion market cap built on AI chip demand. These are massive bets. If AI revenue doesn't materialize, those valuations become hard to justify.
But Microsoft and Google, they're not going anywhere, right? They have the cash to weather a downturn.
Big tech will be fine. They'll write off some bad investments and keep moving. The real carnage would be in the startup ecosystem. A nuclear winter for AI startups, the companies that raised money at massive valuations based on AGI promises, they'd be in trouble.
And the infrastructure? If it's like the fiber optic parallel, compute gets cheap.
That's actually good for developers. If GPU prices crash because the speculative demand dries up, the cost of running AI models goes down. The survivors pick up the pieces and build real businesses on cheap infrastructure.
So the bubble bursting might actually be good for the people building real things with AI.
That's my read. The technology is real, the productivity gains are real, the valuations are the problem. If you're a developer who's learned to use AI effectively, you're creating value. If you're an investor who bet on AGI arriving next year, you might be in trouble.
There's a scenario that really worries me, though. What if LLMs hit a wall and AGI proves impossible with this architecture?
That's the Lacoon scenario. He's saying LLMs are fundamentally limited. They can't understand the physical world, they don't have persistent memory, they can't genuinely reason or plan. If he's right, then all this scaling, more data, more compute, bigger models, it hits diminishing returns. Maybe we need a completely different architecture.
And if that's true, what happens to all the companies that bet the farm on LLMs being the path to AGI?
They pivot, or they die. OpenAI is already pivoting. That's what the developer focus is about. They're realizing the AGI timeline might be longer than they thought, so they need to build sustainable business models now. Anthropic saw this coming and built for developers from day one.
So the smart play is assume LLMs plateau, build tools that create value now, stay flexible for whatever comes next.
That's it. Build on solid foundations, not hype. The future belongs to people who can apply AI to real problems, not the people waiting for AGI to save the day. And honestly, that's always been true. Every major technology shift, the internet, mobile, cloud, the winners were the ones who built practical solutions, not the ones chasing the most ambitious vision.
There's something else I've been thinking about. Even if LLMs plateau, they're still incredibly useful. Like, a tool doesn't have to be sentient to be valuable. Excel isn't sentient. Git isn't sentient. They're still essential.
That's exactly right. And I think that's the healthy mindset. I'm not building my career on the assumption that Claude 5 will be sentient. I'm building my career on the assumption that AI-assisted development is a permanent shift in how we write software. The tools work now. If they get better, great. If they plateau, I still have a massive productivity advantage over developers who didn't learn these skills.
The investors might lose their shirts, but developers who learn to use AI productively will be fine.
That's the takeaway. The bubble might burst for investors, but not for developers. The technology is real and useful. The valuations are the problem. Focus on creating value with the tools you have, not speculating on what might come next.
All right, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. We covered a lot of ground today.
Yeah, we went from dinosaur skeletons to the $600 billion AI revenue gap. That's quite a journey.
And somehow it all connects. Being out in the real world, away from the computer, seeing how normal people work, it gives you perspective. We're in this weird bubble where AI feels inevitable, but most of the world is just going about their business.
Right, and the companies that remember that, that focus on real problems for real people, those are the ones winning. Anthropic figured that out. OpenAI's relearning it the hard way.
And for those of us writing code every day, keep building, keep learning. Don't bet everything on AGI showing up to save the day, but definitely take advantage of the tools we have right now.
Exactly. The technology is real. The productivity gains are real. Whether the investment bubble bursts or not, developers who learn to work with AI are going to be fine. It's the people chasing the hype without building real skills who should be worried.
Well said. All right. Thanks for sharing the DC stories and thanks for the deep dive on all this. It's given me a lot to think about.
Absolutely. And hey, next time you're on the East Coast, definitely make a stop in DC. Just maybe don't mail your valuables via registered mail. Some traditions are better left in the past.
Laughs. Good advice. Although now I kind of want to see what else Harry Winston mailed in a plain brown package.
Right? There's probably a whole Netflix documentary waiting to be made. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, leave a review, all that good stuff. We'll catch you next time on Rubber Duck Radio.
See you next time. And remember, build on solid foundations, not hype. Future you will thank present you.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Take care, everyone.